Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Racism is the underlying condition in our country that leaps out of the mountain of new coronavirus numbers. There is some merciful news, too, this week in the first slowing of confirmed cases. Deaths are now approaching 15,000 total in the U.S., but running far below the White House estimate that as many as 250,000 people could die in the pandemic. Meantime, we're noticing that this blind and brainless bug has an acute sensitivity to social standing in America, to our race and class lines, our work habits, age brackets, our haves and have-nots, as if it read us like a book. We're looking also this hour at the odd and ironic juncture of the end of the Bernie Sanders presidential campaign and the onset of the COVID crisis. Cornel West and Matt Stoller will join us on the political dimension, but first, the racial pattern in the picture. Dr. Kamara Jones is a family physician turned epidemiologist, professor at the Morehouse School of Medicine in Atlanta. She's visiting this spring at the Radcliffe Institute at Harvard. She was ready for the coronavirus.
When I look at how COVID-19 is killing Black folks at such high rates compared to their numbers in the population, right, I am understanding it as COVID-19 is exposing U.S. racism again in very stark fashion. All of a sudden, we have to wake up, as we did a little bit maybe with Katrina when the levees broke, as we did maybe a little bit with the poisoning of the public water supply in Flint, Michigan, but we're waking up again.
Yeah.
But this is faster. This is faster because the bodies are piling up so fast that we cannot ignore them and we can't normalize it. Racism has been operating in this society since its inception. I would say that racism is foundational in our nation's history. Let me tell you how I define racism. Racism is a system, first of all. It's not an individual character flaw, not a personal moral failing, not even a psychiatric illness, as some people have suggested, but it's a system of power that does two things. It structures opportunity and it assigns value. More Black people are exposed to the virus and Black people are more vulnerable to the virus. So more Black people are exposed because the way that educational opportunity and job opportunity and all those opportunities have limited possibilities for Black people, more Black people are kind of on the front lines. Fewer Black people are able to shelter in place and work from home because you can't do that if you're working for the post office. You can't do that if you're a bus driver. You can't do that if you're cleaning the hospital rooms. You know, you can't do that if you are a farmer. So there are ways in which the life opportunities have put people in jobs where they can't safely shelter in place. Or even if they wanted to, maybe they didn't have enough savings or they don't have paid sick leave on their job or whatever. So there are many people who are out there exposed. And then the ones who are essential, letting the rest of us shelter in place, they're not even protected. So I don't know if you've heard of the bus driver Jason Hargrove in Detroit, who posted a video of himself complaining that a passenger got in and was just coughing without covering her cough. Do you know that he days later got sick from the coronavirus and died? There are a lot of people at the front line, the doctors and nurses and the respiratory techs are at the front lines. But so are the sanitation workers. So are the bus drivers. So are the postal workers. So are the home health care workers. And we need to protect them as much as we can.
Dr. Jones, just recite the numbers that mean the most to you. I think we've all seen the figures that, you know, Milwaukee, for example, 25% of the Milwaukee County population, they're 45% of the COVID cases, and they're 70% of the COVID deaths. It's a multiple of 2 and 3. How does that actually happen? People speak of underlying causes. People speak of work patterns, as you're describing. People speak of access to healthcare. Is there a way to break it down usefully?
What has happened is that we're living in different worlds. And we don't even know it. It's like some people are sitting inside a restaurant eating, and they look up and they see a sign that says open, and they don't think anything more about it, and they keep on eating. Hmm. And maybe they wonder why more people don't come in the restaurant or not. Maybe they don't wonder at all. But because that sign is actually a two-sided sign, the restaurant is, after all, in fact, closed to people who are on the outside. The people on the outside know very well that the restaurant is closed because the sign proclaims closed to them, but they can look through the window and see people inside eating. But the people inside the restaurant aren't even wondering about anything. They feel comfortable. They're self-satisfied. They might even feel threatened if somebody else actually came into the restaurant. So they're not trying to think about that. So those two different realities have created the differences in the kinds of jobs. The realities, the way that they are separated, the mechanisms of that two-sided sign actually include residential segregation by race prominently. And that residential segregation by race has been implemented by federal law in many different waves in our society, but especially after World War II, people are thinking, really? As recently as that? Yes. And what happens is that when you segregate people racially, then you can segregate resources racially, and you have segregated schools, and then you have segregated educational opportunities, and then jobs. You have segregated environments. And there's a whole issue of environmental racism.
Come back to the COVID numbers and the ones we don't have. Milwaukee, we know a lot about because it codes these health statistics by race. A lot of cities don't. I don't think New York does. I'm not sure Boston does.
Oh, I'm sure they all do. I'm going to tell you about Milwaukee and why Milwaukee was the first one to step out. Milwaukee was the first one to step out because they understand that looking for evidence of two-sided signs, when I talked about that open-close sign,
right.
You know, that's how racism works, that looking for evidence of two-sided signs is important. We should always be asking, is there something differential going on here by race, by language, by income, by neighborhood, by immigration status, by all different kinds of things, right? And they know that in such a deep way because a year ago, you may not realize or remember this, Milwaukee County made a proclamation. They declared racism to be a public health
crisis.
Yes,
yes, yes. And they have a very, very aggressive public health commissioner.
Yes, yes. And I don't know if he's still the commissioner now, but at that time, they understood that because the Wisconsin Public Health Association before them had declared racism as a public health crisis. So let's go back to COVID-19.
Please, please.
Yes, where I have been describing, you know, a lot of the Black excess deaths as people who are kind of like can't shelter at home. They're essential workers that are enabling us to get our mail, enabling us to get our medicines by mail, enabling us to get our food delivered and all of that, right? Enabling the whole system to work. Imagine that those people all of a sudden went on strike. Hmm. Or worse yet, imagine that all of those people died, right?
Oh.
Where would we be? It would be mayhem. And yet we're not valuing those people like that. This is just one tiny example of how racism saps the strength or could potentially sap the strength of the whole society. We are all in this together, although we are experiencing it very differently because even though we're in it together, we're in separate worlds together.
Dr. Jones, come back to Milwaukee, about which we seem to know a lot, and they've made a lot of moves in a realistic head. What did we learn there about all of us, and what have they shown us in a particular way can be done?
The question, what can be done, implies that we want to do something about it, and we have to want to do something about it. We cannot just absorb these statistics, hold ourselves in horror, or shake our heads in wonder, and do nothing. We cannot just document what's happening. We have to act. One of the ways we have to act is we have to make it easier and safer and more feasible for more Black people to safely shelter in place. That even means decarcerating folks from the prisons, right? Because there are a lot of Black people disproportionately in the prisons. So, you know, let the people who are no risk to society, I would say all of them, but if you wanted to make it fewer of them, those who are over 60 or those with pre-existing conditions, let them get out of that oven of disease. We need to make it easier for those populations to shelter in place, and we need to value the ones who are still working in the home healthcare workers and all of them. We need to give them hazard pay. We need to give them personal protective equipment. We need to understand that they are just as essential as the nurses and the doctors at, I wouldn't say the front line, I'd say they'd be at the finish line of this pandemic. You know, we have made this pandemic really a medical problem when in fact it could have been controlled as a public health problem. But on the vulnerability side, why are we dying more after we're exposed? Because we have been living in communities that have been disinvested, actively neglected, poor food options, especially poor healthy food options, limited green space, lots of pollution, all of this stuff. We carry the burden of all of those unfavorable environments in our bodies as obesity, which then turns into diabetes. In terms of the hypertension, it turns into heart disease and to kidney asthma. Disease and asthma. And those conditions are the ones that if you get the virus, you can have a more severe form of it.
Dr. Jones, I speak as a clinician who sees patients. You've written that discrimination is written into the bodies of people of color, a lot of them, and older people too. Imagine you're seeing a new patient. Describe what you see in the way of a history of discrimination in a 50-year-old woman or man.
It doesn't have to even be something that a patient would articulate.
Yeah.
It has to do with life experiences. I want to say this. Many people think that as a doctor, you are providing health, right? What you're providing is health care. Health is created by the conditions of our lives. So all I would have to see is her address, perhaps, her educational level, her occupation. You know, what I would see would be her life chances and how that has allowed her to grow and to be. What I'm afraid of right now with the COVID-19 pandemic is that, so we're more exposed, so then we get the disease, we're expressing it more seriously, we end up in a hospital, and then maybe the hospital we end up in, they haven't put enough resources there because maybe it's a hospital in our neighborhood, right? And there weren't enough ventilators anywhere, or it may be some other hospital, but there's a shortage. The virus is an equal opportunity infector if it gets to you. So if you are exposed, then it's an equal opportunity infector, right?
Right.
The virus doesn't know the life we've lived. It knows that it can get to you easier because you're out here driving a bus with no protection. And then once it gets in there, it's like, oh, this person has been weakened by the life they live.
Coming up, Mike Davis on the global reach of our healthcare choices. This is Open Source. Mike Davis is a sort of Los Angeles observatory of culture and society, a sometime truck driver, and a MacArthur genius. His breakthrough book, City of Quartz, about LA, hooked me 30 years ago. Mike Davis writes about everything, including viral threats, in a book about avian flu, The Monster at Our Door, was the title, from 2005. I asked Mike Davis this week where we are now, and he said, we're in the early stages of a medical Katrina.
Yeah, it's Katrina 100 times worse. Part of this, of course, is not only to the fact that people of color, because they tend to be in the ranks of minimum wage and very low paid workers, are going to be more exposed to it because they have to go out and work. It also punishes people who live in extended families that rely on kin support networks. But the thing that seems to be particularly devastating are rates of diabetes. And diabetes is higher amongst African Americans than in most other groups. So the pre-existing conditions that are the result of poverty in people's diets is playing a large role in the racial dimension of the infection.
People are also speaking of disproportionate asthma in the minority communities, disproportionate diabetes, and that counts too.
Of course it does, as well as other environmental factors. You know, people who drink water in Flint, Michigan, or live in areas of heavy industrial pollution. Malnutrition is a major comorbidity in all this as well, because if you're malnourished, it compromises your immune system. So does stress, by the way. And this must be a particularly worrying factor amongst frontline health workers.
What we come to see is the numbers of people that are left unprotected against this sort of thing, including gig workers, all sorts of uninsured workers. We realize now that people like me working indoors in a safe house are isolated, but isolation is itself a privilege. What are we learning finally about the way we work?
Well, I mean, I was just outside talking to my letter carrier, who's a friend of mine. And a month ago, I gave him some masks that I had, but the post office has yet to issue him with surgical gloves or with a mask of any kind. Half the delivery guys working for Amazon, even some of the UPS drivers, they're not protected at all. I mean, this is deepening and exposing and widening all the class divides. And we're beginning to see, I think, the beginning of a fight back from workers whose employers failed to provide them with adequate protection. For instance, two recent strikes in Amazon warehouses. But the fact that they do not have available, even for medical personnel, protective masks is quite extraordinary. I mean, for me, one of the abiding images of this whole experience will be the fact that on the same day that President Trump was bragging about how this country had the greatest scientific technological capacity of any nation in the history of the world, the New York Times is devoting a full page of the New York Times to instructions into how to sew a mask.
Mike Davis, in history, these epidemics reveal the societies that they afflict. You've been studying this for a long time. What are you seeing new with clarity, besides this gradient of work advantage and disadvantage? What are you seeing new in that mirror?
You know, on the largest scale, I think this is making more of us aware that pandemics are actually the direct product of capitalist globalization.
Explain that.
Destruction of rainforests, which put us in contact with exotic animal diseases, factory farming, which basically creates particle accelerators for the mutation and spread of new viruses, and big pharma, a global pharmaceutical industry dominated by four or five firms and then six or seven others, which has abdicated the research, development, and manufacture of what we need most, which are vaccines, antivirals, and antibiotics. They're simply not profitable.
This is a story that most people haven't got their head around. We all complain, of course, about pharmaceutical prices. But the fact that Big Pharma basically got out of the anti-infectious disease business, can you explain that?
I mean, look at the market for sexual dysfunction in middle-aged and elderly men. I mean, this is immensely profitable. But if you develop a vaccine, it may be for a disease that will never recur. I mean, the profit margins just don't support it. And of course, this is what refutes the argument that pharmaceutical industry, which after the fossil fuel industry, the biggest lobby in Washington, this refutes the argument that their monopoly, their dominance is necessary because it allows them, with these economies of scale, to produce the essential medicines on which we depend. And it's simply no longer true, if it ever was. They spend more on advertising than they do in R&D. And the real development takes place, first of all, in universities, particularly public universities, from which emerge the new ideas, the new discoveries. And then those are capitalized usually by smaller firms, startups, headed by scientists, very good at turning these things into products. But to be scaled up and become available requires, of course, government investment, government support. Otherwise, they just become niche products, or they're sometimes bought up by Big Pharma, and not always for the sake of Big Pharma marketing them. There are a number of pretty shocking instances where big pharmaceutical companies, Johnson & Johnson, Roche and so on, have actually bought up small firms to suppress their products. They don't want the competition.
We know from the advertising that it's the long-term pills, the statins and the tranquilizers and the sleeping pills and whatnot, that make the money. But where are the antivirals, the lifeline medicines, and where do we go for them now?
I mean, right now, there's, of course, a hothouse of research. And they're also, of course, working feverishly to produce a vaccine. But the question is, who's coordinating this? It's mainly taking place, the kind of self-coordination between researchers themselves. But who's coordinating the ultimate production of this? Mm. And the answer is not really anyone at the highest level, unless you expect that Vice President Pence or Jared Kushner has the capacity to bring all this together. I mean, the obvious way to proceed here is to recognize that public medicine and public expenditure, Medicare and Medicaid, play the largest roles here together with smaller companies. Why do we need the big companies, the monopolies, at all in this process? I mean, big pharma is just basically no longer so much a scientific force as it is a rent collector from the patents they hold, monopolies they exercise over drug production. And this is a lesson that, you know, we need to learn and progressive people need to take a stand on. We need to develop it in a program, starting with public production. This was done in the past. The first flu vaccine was developed by the Army because they feared a repetition of the Spanish flu in World War II. So they got together some hotshot young scientists, including a guy named Jonas Salk, and the Army developed and produced the first flu vaccine.
Interesting.
There's plenty of precedent for this in American history.
Mike Davis, let's talk about the international dimension here, starting with advantages and disadvantages, North and South, the color line as well. That's going to be a new world. It also is uncannily reminiscent of the colonial world. But where do you begin talking about the international justice questions here?
Well, first of all, let's acknowledge an important biological distinction, which is from an immunological sense, there are really two distinct humanities. One humanity is reasonably healthy and well-fed, and in that humanity, epidemic disease, the current pandemic, take their toll mainly on people with chronic illnesses and on the elderly. Now, of course, these chronic illnesses often are associated with poverty and racism in those societies, but on the whole, this humanity is healthy. Then there's another humanity, more than half the human race, which lacks access to clean water, sanitation. A billion people in that humanity live in slums. And that humanity has pre-existing conditions on a far larger scale than in the first. Now, hunger is a major reason that death tolls have always been higher in previous pandemics of influenza, or for that matter, the plague, in poorer countries, because hunger, malnutrition lead to compromised immune systems. Right now, there's 350 million Africans who are suffering from chronic malnutrition. The number of young African kids whose bodies are being stunted by constant hunger. It's been increasing by millions every year over the last 20 years. I mean, in sub-Saharan Africa, there's at least 24 million people still infected with HIV/AIDS. There are millions more with tuberculosis. The health systems have been destroyed in a majority of countries by civil war and by kleptocratic rulers. I mean, nowhere perhaps more dramatically in Nigeria, which has 220 million people and immense oil revenues and incredible cadres of educated, talented people. But basically, its entire medical system has now been privatized. And if you don't have the income, you don't have the access to health care. So we're now on a kind of second wave where COVID-19 is now breaking out in the slums of the world. It's breaking out across Africa, Southeast Asia, and on the outskirts of extremely modern cities.
Yeah.
In India, for example,
right,
where all the high-tech cities are nonetheless surrounded by huge slums without sanitation, with poor access to any kind of medicine. So it seems inevitable but totally avoidable, that the toll taken by this pandemic is probably going to be mainly taken in that second, sicker, poorer humanity.
Mike Davis, you write in The Nation this spring an interesting warning about these two global populations. You say capitalist globalization now appears to be biologically unsustainable in the absence of a truly international public health infrastructure. But such an infrastructure will never exist until people's movements break the power of big pharma and for-profit healthcare.
There will have to be action. I mean, the thing with a pandemic like this is that it can't be just confined to the poor part of the city. It's going to reach Beverly Hills. In fact, it may have started there first because it seems the jet set has been amongst the leading spreaders of the pandemic. Look at Boris Johnson, for example. But the point remains that there will undoubtedly be a series of reforms that will ensure greater protection for wealthy people in wealthy countries. But all of that will leave behind the fundamental ecology of emergent diseases, which is the absence of sanitation, health, and elementary socioeconomic rights in such a large part of the world. The pandemic, of course, is also providing the same opportunity that 9/11 did in the war on terrorism for autocrats to grab power. And the interesting thing about the United States is we have a president and a regime, which is basically, you know, one 24/7 power grab.
Speak of the global assignment here. Laurie Garrett, the plague watcher from way back, said to us last week, it's going to take first the vaccine and then people to take it to 7.5 billion human beings on this earth. Can you imagine how to do that? Is it the thing to be done? Will it ever be done?
No, it's that won't be done. There's absolutely no guarantee that my second humanity in the global south is going to be guaranteed antivirals or vaccination. Now, in previous times, you know, we might have looked at the World Health Organization, but the World Health Organization is almost totally marginal in the current crisis. It's hollowed out. Big companies have not paid their dues to the WHO. It's gotten so bad that the WHO actually is now begging in a street corner. It's crowdsourcing, trying to crowdsource its finances. It's also far too captive to big pharma. It has to go hat in hand to the White House. The Director General has lavish praise on Trump's handling of this. Similarly, cap in hand to Beijing. So we face the fact that right now the only global organization that has the mandate for world health and which has previously led successful campaigns, for instance, to make smallpox extinct and until recently has come close to that with polio, is right now essentially a second-tier actor. So there isn't a international network or organization that can take charge of this, provided that the vaccines are developed in quantity and cheap. And plus, one vaccine isn't a fix. This is not a pandemic. We live in an age of pandemics. Researchers have discovered that there are 400 other coronaviruses possibly capable of leaping to humans.
And this virus mutating as it moves.
Yeah, I mean, again, this is where the World Health Organization is not telling the truth because it said it isn't changing. But in fact, there are two strains circulating in the United States. The original S strain, which appeared in Wuhan, but it's mutated into a more aggressive and more transmissible form called the L strain. And this is exactly what one would expect with RNA viruses in a global epidemic. They mutate, and they mutate on the basis of changing environments. It's the great Spanish flu pandemic, the single greatest mortality event in human history. That virus, H1N1, changed continuously in different parts of the world. Right. Communities which had little experience with flu it would kill up to 50% or more of the population.
Yeah. Mike Davis, we will be living in a different world when this comes to an end, and I want you to imagine it, describe it.
No, I mean, we face alternative futures which we can help decide. Obviously, lots of people are going to draw the conclusion that successful management of pandemics requires some sort of autocratic or even totalitarian surveillance society. Hungary has turned the country virtually into a dictatorship. Viktor Orban, the president of Hungary, now has the ability to rule by decree without any kind of check on his power. But the question is whether out of this we will establish the kind of democratic and universal health system that, thanks to Bernie Sanders and hundreds of thousands of his supporters, has become the most important political issue in the domestic agenda for the last several years. And it's an astonishing opportunity here, but it requires that we don't entirely forsake the streets. There's no reason, as the Amazon workers have shown in this strike, that you can't go out and carry on a strike and still stay 10 feet apart from the nearest person.
Mike Davis's new book with John Wiener is Set the Night on Fire, L.A. in the 60s. Coming up, changing the subject, but not entirely, the anti-monopolist Matt Stoller and the preacher at large Cornel West, with two very different takes on the end of the race for the Democratic presidential nomination. This is Open Source. Matt Stoller has been a restless, unorthodox, progressive Democrat as long as I've known him, which is 16 years, through five presidential seasons. His big book last year was Goliath, about monopoly power and the lost populist tradition of fighting it. He has worked his way in and out of congressional staffs, in and out of the Bernie Sanders campaigns. I asked him for a political obit.
The problem that I think Bernie encountered, and that they all encountered, was that Democrats only wanted to beat Trump. They wanted to beat Trump, and that's it. And so the question of how do you beat Trump, nobody knows how to beat Trump because the election is in the future and it's a somewhat random event. So they're not really asking, how are you going to beat Trump? What they're really asking is, why did Trump get elected in the first place?
Interesting.
And the narrative of why Trump won in the first place determines which candidate is appropriate to beat him. So one theory, and this is Biden's theory, is that Trump is an anomaly. He's just a racist, and America was racist for him. And Clinton was a bad candidate. She was a woman, and Putin intervened. And there were all of these extenuating circumstances. But fundamentally, the status quo was great. Obama, Biden was great. They were winners. It worked. And then this anomaly came along, and all we need to do is get back to the status quo of Obama, Biden winners. In this case, it would just be Biden. Because
that's the line that we got to get it back to normal. The other line is, no, normal was the problem.
Well, here's the issue with that. No one ever made that case, because in order to make that case, that the reason Trump got elected is because things weren't working, you have to say that things weren't working under Obama. And that means you have to be willing to say Obama didn't do a particularly good job as president. And no one was willing to say that. Because no one was willing to say that, the only narrative that Democratic voters heard was that Trump is an anomaly, that there were all of these weird extenuating circumstances, everything from America suddenly becoming a more racist country to Putin intervening to everything, but there were serious policy problems under the Obama administration. They never heard that. And no one would make that argument. And so Joe Biden's argument that we just need to get back to the status quo worked. So that's my theory as to what happened.
Matt, rerun the brief, dramatic history of these Democratic primaries. The shocker was that Bernie won Iowa after the incredible snafu of counting the votes. He won New Hampshire. He won Nevada. He was said to be, there was a kind of warning in the New York Times that there's your nominee, Democrats. And suddenly, a couple of weeks later, Super Tuesday, he's gone. How did that happen? And what did the coronavirus story, which eclipsed politics in a way, what did it have to do with it?
Well, Bernie did not do as well in 2020 as he did in 2016.
He had Elizabeth Warren competing for his votes.
Yeah, but he lost a lot of the white working class voters that he had in 2016. He didn't lose them to Warren. He lost them to Biden. He lost a lot of rural voters. I mean, he got crushed in Michigan. He had beat Clinton in Michigan, and he lost to Biden in Michigan. He basically became a more fringy lefty candidate in 2020 and less populist.
There's another thing that I didn't notice in 16, but it stood out in 2020, that Bernie isn't a Democrat. He does not come out of the Democratic Party, the way George McGovern, say, did. He was a child politically of Hubert Humphrey, a dissident child, but he came out of the party and he took it over, an insurgent campaign. Bernie was much more like a hostile takeover. He never embraced the party he was trying to lead.
He's not a real revolutionary. It's not a hostile takeover. He personally is a kitten when it comes to the Democratic Party. It's a fake independence from the Democratic Party.
Hmm.
You saw that with the bailout bill that just passed. There's a bailout bill that passed a couple weeks ago. It was a couple $1 trillion. Most of that was going to Wall Street. And like Bernie voted for it and was not a thorn in the side, was actually more of an advocate for Wall Street than he was against it. So it was Warren. But it's just kind of like, you know, it was bizarre. Like the guy frames himself as some sort of revolutionary, but then also talks about how all of his proposals are just common sense. But the revolutionary, it's not American style revolution. It's not like Thomas Paine, common sense. It's like this weird European style rhetoric, like social democracy, as opposed to like New Deal, right? And then he's actually not really at all like anti-establishment. I think that the cherry on top for the campaign is that like the last major thing that he does in a campaign that shows that the left is demonstrably weaker than it was 4 years before, the last major thing he does in the campaign before dropping out is to support a Wall Street bill that, you know, the Wall Street bailout. He goes and he supports that, and then he drops out. And I think that just says it all, right? That just says it all.
Spell it out.
Well, it says that there was never any there. The left is just fake. They have no conception of what power is or what corporate power is. So they're just a brand. It's embarrassing. And so that's what it means. You know, Bernie became popular in 2016 because of the frustration that people felt towards Wall Street. People didn't like that Clinton was associated with Wall Street. They didn't like the bailouts. They didn't like the foreclosures. And that's what animated both Bernie and Trump, but Bernie on the Democratic side. It's also why Elizabeth Warren became popular. She very directly became popular because of her opposition to a lot of the banking scandals that came out of the bailouts. And then over the course of the next few years, Bernie organizes around Medicare for All. So he organizes around healthcare. And then Warren organizes around Wall Street and finance. But it's so tissue thin in terms of real substance that faced with the most significant both public health challenge and financial challenge in 10 years, certainly public health challenge in our lifetimes, but financial crisis, certainly it's as bad or worse than the financial crisis in 2008. And the Democrats have two candidates who are both popular within the Democratic Party, both can raise enormous amounts of money, both can organize, both have policy apparatuses, and they get nothing out of any of the congressional packages that pass. Zero, right? That is pathetic. That is totally pathetic.
Cornel West teaches philosophy at Harvard, and he preaches his lay Christian conscience to the country. I ask him to look forward and back at the last Bernie Sanders campaign.
The struggle goes on, and the campaign itself was always just one particular moment in a much larger struggle for freedom and justice.
Cornel West, you were one of his celebrated surrogates with AOC. You gave a wonderful speech connecting Bernie's Brooklyn and Jewish roots with your own political ideals and the prophetic fire in Black American history. Bernie, to you, who was he?
Oh, Bernie Sanders is my dear brother. He's an unprecedented historical candidate for president, has been a major force for good and justice in America. There's simply nobody like him in terms of the American past and present. The movement made him. He made the movement. All of us were part of the movement. And he's not a god. He's not a deity. He had his own challenges and limitations. But most importantly, he represented high levels of integrity, honesty, and decency in a moment of deep decadence and decay in the American ruling class. And now, as it comes to a close, we have to see what kinds of strategies and tactics we should pursue in light of our overarching vision, which is always the empowerment of the least of these, the empowerment of the wretched of the earth, the empowerment of poor and working people.
AOC said something like that. The important thing she said about joining Bernie was that you were joining a movement. But what is missing going forward in 2020 and then the rest of time this year?
Well, we're locked into a dilemma, though, brother. I find myself committed to two particular projects that are in deep tension. One is to be a strong part of a anti-fascist coalition against Trump to try to push him out, given the levels of unbelievable greed and corruption and lies and crimes that have taken place. On the other hand, the second project is rendering accountable the neoliberal wing of the ruling class. See, Trump is the neo-fascist wing of the ruling class, but the neoliberal wing of the ruling class that Biden represents has to be accountable, both in terms of his past as well as his present and future. And so the question is, how do you make the case that Biden is at present an alternative to a neo-fascist, and at the same time recognize that Biden is still a kind of neoliberal disaster because his ties to Wall Street, his ties to military-industrial complex, being the architect of the largest prison system in the modern world, targeting poor, especially black folk, architect behind invasion and occupation of Iraq, over 500,000 precious brothers and sisters in Iraq dead, as well as American soldiers, each all of them precious. How do you tell that truth about a neoliberal politician who now constitutes the only alternative to a neo-fascist president? I think it's going to be a difficult one. It's a deep tension, but I refuse to keep track of the vicious lies of neo-fascist Trump and not also keep track of some of the lies of Biden. How do you keep track of the crimes of Trump and also acknowledge some of the complicity with the crimes of a Biden? You see, this is a very, very difficult situation, my brother.
Can you imagine Joe Biden coming to grips with that past, especially Iraq, but a long history of corporate friendship?
No way that he has inhabited the neoliberal world where he wouldn't even acknowledge. He doesn't even acknowledge, even though he was bragging about being the architect of the new Jim Crow, along with Strom Thurmond and the others, but he hardly even acknowledges it. Now, he did acknowledge the unleashing of Wall Street greed. I was glad to see that with the Glass-Steagall, which I think is just one of the more horrific moments in American history in the last few decades, the unleashing of that of Wall Street greed. He played a fundamental role. I would say the same thing about Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas. Now, if he were to come clean on those, then it would say, okay, lo and behold, we've got a mature Biden at this point. But the damage has already been done. And so you could imagine, you know, folk coming at me and said, oh, my God, here's Brother West coming down on the neoliberal centrists in such a way that we can't come together. We want to have a kumbaya Democratic Party against the neo-fascist Trump. And you say, no, that's a neoliberal fantasy. There's always going to be deep tensions between somebody like myself and the neoliberal wing of the ruling class, because I'm critical of the ruling class in both of its wings. But I understand the difference between the neoliberal wing and the neo-fascist wing. Right. But don't bring me into any kind of complacency about the greed and the corruption of the ruling class in both of its forms. The dominant wing of the Democratic Party now with the neoliberal unity crushing we leftists, supporting Brother Bernie. And of course, then, you know, Brother Bernie has to then make some decisions about how he's going to relate to Biden. Look at Brother John Lewis. You know how much I love that brother. I take a bullet for him, not my heart, but on my side. And he comes up, talks about Biden as man of conscience, man of courage, going to make a great president. I said, my brother John Lewis, quit lying. Biden is not a man of courage and conscience. He's not going to make a great president. He's going to be a major disappointment, but he's much better than a neo-fascist Trump. Tell the people the truth. Respect people enough to tell them the truth.
What's your account of what happened to the Bernie campaign? He was sailing toward the nomination after Nevada. Come Super Tuesday, though he won California, he's over.
Well, one, the good news is that he's reshaped, not just the Democratic Party, but reshaped the public discourse in a magnificent way. And when I say he, I'm talking about he in the movement. He's captured the hearts, minds, and souls of the majority of young brothers and sisters of all colors. This is very important, even though a lot of them didn't come out to vote. He's captured their minds and hearts and souls. That's good, because that's a sign that they're not cold and callous to these ecological catastrophic possibilities and nuclear catastrophic possibilities and wealth inequality and white supremacy and male supremacy and mass incarceration and homophobia and so forth. Keeping track of the humanity of Jews and Arabs and Palestinians, very important. But what did he fail to do? What we failed to do was to convince enough of my generation and your generation, and especially to convince enough of black people.
What would you urge Bernie about negotiating some sort of peace arrangement with the Biden campaign? What will you do?
He's got to bring some serious power and pressure to bear so that when it comes to personnel and when it comes to policies tilted toward the poor and working people of all colors, he's got to be strong when he engages in his dialogues with Brother Biden. And it's going to be a test of integrity again. We're going to be cutting no deals and trying to somehow attenuate the role of progressive and leftist, because we, on the one hand, we can't win without progressive and leftist, but on the other hand, to try to get us somehow on the cheap and get us conforming to the very things that we fight against: Wall Street domination, militarism, and the surveillance and security state, to think that somehow we're not going to raise our voices. That's not going to happen.
We're not talking about a platform committee deal or a handshake.
That,
what
you know,
would
we
it,
went through that.
What
we
would
went
it take?
Through that 2016, my brother, went to 7 cities in 2.5 months and tried to reshape that thing. We lost on every issue other than Wall Street. But no, we're talking about more than platform. We're talking about personnel and policy.
Right.
What voices at the highest level? You see, that's what we're talking about here, because what Biden's probably going to do is he's bringing in all the old Obama people. He's bringing in all the old Clinton people. And we got neoliberalism all over again. And they say, well, but Brother West, he's so much better than Trump. I understand. I do understand. But as part of the anti-fascist coalition, I'm still raising my voice and telling certain truths about powers that be, even as we can be a part of a larger coalition to push Trump out. And that's going to be our challenge. That's the dance. That's the kind of serious project we have to engage in. And we've yet to go anywhere down that road yet.
I want to follow you every step of the way, Cornell. It's always a joy to hear you on our program, and we wish you and the country the best.
We just stand solidarity with all of this suffering, but never give up. Don't cave in or sell out. Keep fighting. Keep swinging. Love. Justice.
Cornell West, thank you.
Thank you, my brother. And I appreciate you, because I people have been calling and calling, and I'm trying to decide, just like when you first called, whether I should say anything at all. Even my mother was saying, oh, honey, you know, all these controversies are so hard. It's hard for me to get to church. People coming at you all the time. Maybe you shouldn't say too much. I say, well, Mom, you know, we're going to pray on this thing. But if the Lord is calling us to try to say certain things, then we all of us got to just try to go with it. But I'm going to try to be as sensitive as I can, given whatever fire I got inside of it. She said, all right, I'm praying, but I just hope it's not too controversial. So then when I got all these calls yesterday, I said, look, I got to pray on this. And when I did pray, the first thing that hit me was the person who I want to talk to voice, because I can't give you a hug, is Brother Chris. We go back a long time.
Thank you, Cornel West, Matt Stoller, Mike Davis, and Kamara Jones. There's lots more on our website at radioopensource.org, including, if you need a pick-me-up, a special phone conversation we had this week with President Trump, as played by the impressionist J.L. Coven. Our producer, Adam Coleman, is talking to writers about close reading in this time of social distance. First up, the novelist Emily Gould. To hear it, subscribe to Radio Open Source on Patreon. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time on Open Source.
Hub
and Spoke. Audio Collective.